Members of Congress, I now have the high privilege and distinct honor of presenting to you His Excellency Benjamin Netanyahu, Prime Minister of Israel. Thank you.
This is not a clash of civilizations. It's a clash between barbarism and civilization. America and Israel must stand together.
I'm Garth Mullins. This is Crackdown. Episode 55, The Man in the High Castle.
We turn now to the immigration crackdown. ICE detentions have reached all-time highs. The video taken shows seven federal agents, all masked, pinning 48-year-old Narciso Barranco to the ground, repeatedly punching him in the head before pushing him into an unmarked vehicle.
The number of Palestinians being killed by Israeli forces while waiting for food is going up by the hour. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees has described the distribution centers as death traps.
The aftermath of strikes that could reshape the region. The U.S. military says it bombed three of Iran's key nuclear sites. Iran's Revolutionary Guard warned of a severe response, and Tehran continues to insist that diplomacy is not an option while Israel continues its attacks.
There's something I've been wanting to explore on the show for months now, and there's just no getting around it. Global politics are much grimmer today than when we started making the show back in 2019. I've been worried about the return of fascism since I was a teenager. Back in the 1980s, Vancouver was home to a handful of small fascist militias. Tony McAleer, leader of a group called White Aryan Resistance, went to my high school. His group had a cache of weapons ready for the racial holy war. In Ontario, the Heritage Front recruited thousands. One night, a couple of them tried to burn down my apartment. They failed, but later, they kicked the shit out of me in the snow. These were scary times, but at least our opponents were disorganized and outside of elected office. Since then, I felt this lurking menace in my bones, like a distant rumbling, but getting louder. Over the years, the Nazis grew and organized, eventually surfacing from the underground, emerging onto the world stage with money, power, and a new legitimacy. Today's far right is different than it was in Hitler and Mussolini's time. Naomi Klein and Astra Taylor wrote a piece in The Guardian called The Rise of End Times Fascism, and I think it captures a key difference. Unlike their predecessors, the new fascists have all but abandoned visions of a coming golden age. Instead, they simply hope to build fortresses from which they can endure the coming apocalypse.
We have been ripped off for decades by nearly every country on Earth, and we will not let that happen any longer.
To put it bluntly, the authors write, the most powerful people in the world are preparing for the end of the world, an end they themselves are frenetically accelerating. Canadians often think about the rise of fascism as something happening somewhere else. America, Israel, India, Italy, Germany, or France. But the truth is, the rise of fascism is happening here at home, too. Albeit more insidiously.
A new Stats Canada report revealing that the gap between the rich and the poor has widened at the fastest pace on record.
RCMP released a 75-page ministerial briefing binder earlier this week, and it contains a clear message to the political powers that be that the National Police Force needs more, much more. Much more.
This didn't come out of nowhere. For decades, Canada has been quietly transferring money and power away from democratically accountable social services and towards corporations and cops. It's been a gradual shift, or perhaps a gradual return. We've gone from being a country that at least attempts to solve social problems to one where we simply manage them, with police force, intimidation, and state violence. It's the perfect incubator for fascism. And a major figure in this story is the mayor of Vancouver.
This is the Vancouver police. All persons in the street need to move back to the HIV lane sign on the south side.
It's April 5th, 2023, and our team has just arrived at a major police action taking place blocks from Crackdown Studio. On the orders of Vancouver's new mayor, Ken Sim, the police are banishing homeless people living in tents along Hastings Street, and a large group of protesters has assembled to try and stop them. The cops tell us they're not going to let journalists get anywhere near the action, despite the fact that these kind of media exclusion zones are illegal in Canada. Crackdown producer Sam Fenn approaches the barricades and gestures towards the two officers standing guard.
I'm media, can I come through please?
We're not letting anyone in.
Why not? People should be able to report on this stuff, don't you think?
You can report from here.
Newsworthy.
You can report from here.
From here? Yeah. You can't see what you guys are doing from here.
There's other media outlets there as well.
It's unfortunate, but
that's kind of the point though, right? To keep us out here so that we can't see what you're doing?
No.
When you say?
The point of making it barriers for everyone's safety. At this point, the answer is no, you're not coming. Simple answer.
We decide to try again. This time, Sam speaks to a sergeant and tells him, we don't think it's legal to keep us away. He quietly agrees to let us pass through the barricade. Once inside, the scene is surreal. We join a crowd of protesters, community members, and Indigenous elders, including many people you've heard on the show over the years. The group stands almost nose to nose with a line of police officers. The cops make their intentions clear. They will slowly, methodically push the protesters back until they reach the next homeless person's tent. Then they'll force them to leave the street, throwing their things into a garbage truck.
They're now moving forward.
Get out of the way, pigs! There's nowhere for us to back up to!
Most of the cops wear a stony face as they advance in fits and starts, sometimes lingering for up to 10 minutes without moving at all. The crowd of protesters is packed into the street so tightly that we can't really move from side to side. We're just stuck there, endlessly face to face with the same cop. The situation feels combustible, particularly when the police begin to shove an Indigenous woman in a wheelchair.
Look at this, Alvin!
Stop it! This is fucking assault!
Do not touch my drum!
Do not touch
me! You're gonna back us up into the fucking sidewalk, you idiots!
Do not let the police instigate a riot! The police want blood and we will not give it to them!
Someone living in an apartment above the street begins to blare out Amazing Grace from a boombox on their balcony. And as we listen, the Vancouver Police Department continues to push us backwards, using their bicycles like battering rams.
This is a fucking operation!
Through the chaos, I see a man on the sidewalk. He looks confused and overwhelmed because the cops have just trashed his tent. People gather around trying to comfort him, but I'm not sure what they can say. After all, the entire country is in the midst of a housing affordability crisis.
New research from RBC shows that buying a home in Canada has never been so unaffordable.
You know, when we think of a landlord, we often think of an individual person with an investment property. But this study says that these large corporations have now taken over 85 to 90% of all rental suites over the last few years.
The Ottawa Mission is sounding the alarm over rising rates of homelessness in Ottawa and across Canada. Homelessness and food insecurity have been on the rise since before the pandemic, and the situation is not improving. CTV's Peter Sperling.
All persons in the street need to move back to the HIV lane sign on the south side.
We're
now moving forward.
Oh, we're going to get really hurt.
Where are people being sent? The people you're decamping, where are they being sent to?
Well, there are resources on scene who can,
what resources?
Who can line up. I don't specifically know their titles or names, but it's people from...
Wouldn't you think that would be something you'd want to know if you did this?
Here's Crackdown producer Sam Fenn, once again speaking to a VPD officer, as just feet away, his colleagues throw yet another person's tent and belongings into the garbage.
Because, I mean, where are people supposed to go? Like, you're going to decamp them where? To where? The shelters are full.
With like, the forms and everything.
Oh, there's forms.
To sign them up for shelters and other housing options.
Other housing options?
Yeah.
Like what?
I don't know.
You don't know?
I'm not the one that contacted them to come out and speak with them. I didn't read all that stuff.
Right. You didn't read all that stuff.
I didn't.
Didn't want to prep on that before you got here today to decamp people from their houses?
It's not my responsibility to know all of that information for them. That's why there's people coming to give that information to them.
Later, the Vancouver Sun would release internal City Hall emails from the days leading up to the April 5th police action. They revealed that Ken Sim and the city knew there weren't nearly enough shelter spaces to house the people they were clearing from the street. By the end of the day, the police had stolen and trashed 90 tents, and they'd filled the garbage trucks with 7 tons of people's belongings. The campers were still homeless, but now without any kind of shelter and without their stuff. It only took one day for new tents to show up on Hastings Street, and the cops stole and trashed those as well. The same thing happened day after day, until by the end of April, Ken Sim had spent over $500,000 evicting homeless Vancouverites to nowhere. And the vast majority of the funds went to the cops.
Vancouver taxpayers will again be reaching into their pockets to pay for policing. The city is earmarking tens of millions of dollars next year for the VPD, and its officers are set to become the highest paid in the country.
Vancouver Mayor Ken Sim, flanked by his fellow councillors and members of the city's police force, vowing to clean up and reorder Vancouver's downtown east side, a place he says is plagued by social disorder and rampant crime.
The downtown east side and Vancouver as a whole has become a hub for organized crime and gang activity. This stops now.
That day back in 2023 was just the opening salvo. In the months and years since, Ken Sim has all but declared war on the downtown east side. Last February, Sim and his fellow ABC city councillors passed a motion to pause any new supportive housing projects across the entire city. And he promised to transform the downtown east side by opening it up to more commercial development.
They're calling this a crackdown on organized crime in the downtown east side. What does that look like?
Mi Jung, what we heard today was part policy, part branding, and a whole lot of politics.
Ken Sim's plan, predictably, relies on a massive amount of policing. For the past 6 months, the VPD has been carrying out a project they call Task Force Barrage. The program cost $5 million and was never approved by City Council. Its lofty goal is to solve the neighborhood's humanitarian crisis through what the VPD calls high-visibility policing. Ever since, I've seen groups of 6 and 8 cops marching down Hastings, clearing the corners. Last week, around 7 police vehicles straddled the sidewalk as they arrested a guy near Van Deer.
Yeah, I'm Scotty Arcondis. Been downtown for the last 10 years or so. Been down on the east side for about 10 years.
Member of the Crackdown editorial board?
Yeah, you betcha.
Scotty says Mayor Ken Sim would never have been able to divert so much taxpayer money to the cops if the media hadn't spent years portraying the downtown east side as some kind of zombie nightmare. The version of the neighborhood most Vancouverites see on the news is a crime-ridden, amoral place, something uncontrollable and unredeemable. But that's not the downtown east side that Scotty knows.
I'm a neighborhood guy. I hang out everywhere here. I'm a big arts guy. I love that all the punk rock bands show up here. All the heavy metal shows come here. This is the spot. This is where all the freaks hang out. And I'm one of those freaks.
One thing's for sure. The government has no business complaining about the situation on Hastings Street. After all, they're the ones who created it.
Blight is death to a city. And these dwellings, built with such hope and care at the turn of the century, are dying board by board.
If you want to see a living history of Canada's worst public policy failures, just go to the downtown east side. Around one-third of the neighborhood's residents are Indigenous, far higher than any other part of Vancouver. And almost all the Indigenous people I know on the downtown east side have family histories with residential schools or the 60s scoop. Disastrous colonial programs attempting to rob them of their culture and community.
While the area contains only 5% of Vancouver's population, it houses 14% of the city's old age pensioners and 20% of families on social assistance.
The downtown east side is also full of disabled people, injured people, people with mental illnesses, traumatized people, and neglected people. In other words, people harmed by the government. And most of them, like Scotty, live in tiny single-room hotels that have fallen into serious disrepair. And that's why so many people in the neighborhood prefer to spend their time outside on Hastings Street.
This is our common area. This is our living room. This is our baccarat room. This is our everything. I myself am low income. All my peers down here are low income. There is not a single place in this city that I could afford to live, except for this neighborhood.
The downtown east side has been a place of immense social suffering and government neglect for decades. But it's also been a place where people learn how to help each other, how to work together, and how to heal. That's maybe the downtown east side's deepest irony, that structurally imposed alienation has forced its residents to come together, making it one of Vancouver's most vibrant neighborhoods.
This is the only place that I can say that I live in a community. I know everyone that I pass on the street, and we have a lot of familial ties out here.
Maybe paint a picture for people who don't understand that. Like, how is it? What's a thing that would happen here that wouldn't happen in another neighborhood?
Well, you know, every person I pass in the morning, I say, "Hey, good morning," and what I get back in return is, "Hey, good morning. How are you, Scotty?" So a lot of us don't really leave this area because we're so comfortable being here.
The outgoing police chief of the Vancouver Police Department is standing behind the results of the police's project Task Force Barrage.
Throughout today's police board meeting, Palmer and the rest of the VPD's leading officers underlined the result of Task Force Barrage, which has come under scrutiny in the face of complaints from a whistleblower who is purportedly a police officer, and besides alleging arrest quotas, has said the project is politically motivated.
Mayor Ken Sim and the leaders of the Vancouver Police Department have said that Task Force Barrage only targets organized crime, that it's not about going after people like Scotty and other residents of the downtown east side. But Scotty says all the extra cops make him and his neighbors a lot less safe.
Basically, there is a cop on every single block on this street, if not several. And the sense of fear down here for normal residents who are just going about their daily lives, they have no escape from that looming shadow and that looming threat of police brutality and of just the threat of corporealism. The man in the high tower is looking down on our neighborhood, and I can feel the shadow casting a grim future upon us.
So, to start with, can you introduce yourself? Maybe finish your cookie first.
Wonderful. Yeah.
Good start. Works. Good start. For the remainder of today's show, I want to play you a conversation I recently had with a young person who lives in Vancouver named Mazel, because I think it'll give you a good sense of how our current housing policies are failing people, particularly young people. Mazel tells me she grew up in rural northern BC and that she always felt different from the people around her.
Well, what were you like as a kid?
I liked snowboarding. I liked longboarding. I was a musician from a very young age.
What'd you play?
I played bass.
Nice.
But I mainly produced music on the computer over, like, Ableton.
I've got a couple of beats that I made that I would love to show you.
I wanted to capture the feeling that I got when I was driving at nighttime. And a lot of the music that I would play while I was driving at night was synth pop and stuff like that, you know, it sounded a lot like this song. So I grew up out in the East Kootenays, Kimberley, Cranbrook area.
Mm-hmm. What was the dress code like when you were growing up there?
Plain.
Yeah.
Like, if you wore punk clothes or something, or you wore shit that was different than everybody else, you were the antichrist of the fucking town. Like, I tried to be different at one point. I was like, nope, that was a mistake. You know, these are all self-done tattoos. Almost all of my tattoos are self-done. Then if I would have done these tattoos back home, especially the face tattoos, I would have been a pariah.
So did you sort of wear a mask?
Mm-hmm. I was not me. I grew up being a very closeted person in terms of everything. It took me forever to actually come out because I was scared to. Like, when I was growing up out in the Kootenays, I couldn't be myself. Out of fear of somebody potentially taking me and dragging me behind a truck up in the bush because they didn't like that I'm queer or whatever.
What were your folks like?
I know I didn't meet my dad until I was 18, and I barely knew him before he passed away. And my mom, she was an alcoholic and used coke.
Mazel says her mom was friends with lots of dealers, and that she'd often ask Mazel to deliver packages for her. At the time, Mazel didn't know what she was doing, but looking back, she's pretty sure her mom was using her as a mule.
So did that sort of color your relationship with her?
Yeah. I don't have a relationship with her now.
Yeah.
It was a largely unhappy childhood, full of neglect and prejudice. And by the time Mazel was in grade 4, she was already doing drugs.
I started smoking weed when I was like 10 or 11.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was the heaviest drug user out of anybody I know back home. It was hard to get drugs, especially for the first couple of years because of how young I was.
Right.
People did not take me seriously. My mom had an Oxycontin prescription. My grandpa had a Percocet prescription.
Right.
So I started just stealing theirs.
And what was that like? What did the Oxys do for you?
I was like, oh my God. I felt like I finally found that thing that was missing. I finally felt like, holy shit, this is what I've been missing for so long. First is like I'd take 1-2 pills here and there, you know, just enough to get high every so often. Once I actually got wired, I had to steal too much from them. They started noticing. And from there, it was just any opioids I could get my hands on, you know. I would get hydrocodone, cough syrup for lean, until I got into doing heroin. The first time I smashed it, obviously, you get that rush. Trust me, when they say your first time doing heroin, you will never feel that feeling like that again, and you will chase that rush for the rest of your fucking life. They're not lying.
So do you remember the first time you got dope sick?
Vaguely.
Like, how old would you have been?
13.
Had you heard about dope sickness before?
No,
so that took you totally by surprise.
Yeah, I had no idea what being dope sick was. I didn't know that you could be physically addicted to a drug. I thought I just had a flu at first.
Yeah.
I had aches and pains that I wasn't used to and feelings that I wasn't used to, and I was craving something. I just didn't know what I was craving until I got more oxys in me, and everything went away.
Around this time, Mazel started to spend longer and longer periods away from home. she'd crash at a friend's place for the night and not tell her mom about it. And gradually, she learned she could stretch to several nights in a row. And her mom still didn't react.
Nothing happened. And I was like, wow, apparently I can just do this. And I just got bolder and bolder from there, you know? Well, fuck, if she's gonna let me just do whatever I want to do, I may as well move where I want to move.
And did your mom try to get you back?
No. She was happy I was gone, as far as I know.
Mazel was determined to stay off the radar of the Ministry of Children and Family Development because she didn't want to get thrown into the foster system and because she didn't want them to look at her sibling situation back home. For years, Mazel dreamed of living in Los Angeles, which she imagined to be basically the opposite of the East Kootenays. But in the meantime, Mazel figured Vancouver could be a decent substitute.
Do you remember arriving in Vancouver?
Yeah, I do. We came down here, me and my ex-partner, we came down here on the Greyhound. And I remember the first day we got here, we were staying with a friend in Burnaby. Wow, this is like a bougie-ass city. Everything looks so fancy. And then they took us down to downtown Eastside, and I was like, ah, there's the hood. This is what I'm used to. Grimy, poor, but everybody is kind of in a community, you know?
So you could be a more authentic self when you moved here.
I could be myself,
yeah.
Point blank, you know?
Right.
But I could dress how I wanted. I could talk. I didn't have to hide anymore, you know? I didn't feel like I was constantly on edge about every little thing that I did, said, and wore.
But there were downsides to Vancouver as well. And the main one was how impossibly expensive the housing was. Vancouver didn't have any market housing that Mazel could afford, and she didn't want to try to get into social or supportive housing, because that could alert the Ministry of Children and Family Development.
And so from 15 to 18, you were just staying...
On the street.
On the street.
Yeah. I stayed in a tent mostly down by the waterfront at Crab Park. It wasn't bad in the summers, but once you start to get into fall and winter, it gets really cold, rainy, gross.
You get wet, you don't get unwet for a long time.
You're wet for the entire winter.
And Mazel says the other big problem with Vancouver was that its drug supply was even more fucked up than the supply she was used to back home.
Heroin was gone when I came down here. I could not find heroin down here. I thought I had found heroin, but I found fentanyl. I just remember blank. Just went blank.
So that first hit was fentanyl.
Yeah.
And you overdosed on the first hit.
Yeah. Didn't have to go to the hospital because I had somebody near me and they Narcan'd me.
Right.
And kept me alive.
I'm glad they did.
That was a huge shock to me. That was a huge shock.
Mazel was now 18 years old, and she'd spent the last 3 years living on the street. Mazel remembers feeling totally drained, like she couldn't take it anymore. And so she decided to try to get into supportive housing, one of Vancouver's only options for low-income people. Mazel's counselor was able to get her into a place called St. Helens that specialized in housing young people with mental health problems. The building was owned by the government, but that didn't mean it was going to be a walk in the park.
So when you moved into St. Helens off the street, it didn't feel safe to you? Like you were maybe safer than the street, yeah. but not safe.
No, I knew that there was still risk. It was disgusting. Like, first night, rats running around my room. I could hear them. You get bugs and shit. Wake up the next morning, wanted to have a shower, but you have to share the fucking bathroom that has the shower with the entire floor. And it's like, you don't know if somebody's just going to walk in or if there's going to be shit in the shower, literally.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're young still and living with, like, full-grown adults, it really makes you think about how safe you really are at times.
Yeah.
It's shocking to hear that, like, kids that young were being put into that building. Like, you can just imagine how vulnerable they were. And
this is Jen St. Denis, a journalist with the Tyee. For years, Jen operated as one of the only full-time reporters whose beat was the downtown East Side. And she says that it was around 2024 when she first started hearing rumors about St. Helens.
I got a tip about that I should FOI this specific thing with Coe's Mental Health. what these documents showed was really, really shocking. Like, there was all these photos that I got that were just like blood on the floor or whatever, rats and stuff.
I think maybe the language in the piece is tenants living with sewage in their rooms for months.
Yeah, living with sewage in their rooms. It had just been really not maintained properly. They just basically had like just this horrible list of problems in this building that, you know, was supposed to be housing like these vulnerable young people with mental health issues.
For years, VANDU members have told me similar things. That they live in government-funded supportive housing, but that the building isn't fit to house anyone, let alone the disabled and vulnerable residents who live there. I heard stories about tenants in wheelchairs who had to drag their bodies up a staircase every day because their building refused to fix the elevator. I heard stories of women living with no door on their room, and stories of gangs taking over buildings. It wasn't a problem that was confined to a single housing operator. It was happening across the whole supportive housing sector, and the government didn't seem to want to do anything about it. Jen says that was one of the most troubling things about St. Helens. Everyone seemed to know how bad it was there, but for some reason, that didn't make a difference.
People were very well aware of what was happening at St. Helens. They were aware of it for years, and nothing changed.
Jen says one of the documents in the FOI mentioned, quote, the sensitivities that exist between the operator and its funder. It turned out that St. Helens was operated by an organization called ATIRA, which was run by a woman named Janice Abbott. And Janice just so happened to be married to Shane Ramsey, the guy in charge of BC Housing. This was a shocking conflict of interest. Shane was the guy running the Crown agency that funded Janice's organization. And more than that, he was the guy who was ultimately responsible for ensuring that ATIRA did a good job running its buildings, including St. Helens.
There is kind of this assumption that you can tell in the correspondence that things are not happening because of this conflict of interest.
CEO of BC Housing Shane Ramsey says he can no longer solve the complex problems faced by BC Housing.
Basically, it was a big scandal. Shane Ramsey left BC Housing, Janice Abbott left ATIRA, and there was this whole shakeup of ATIRA.
UBC professor and anthropologist Danya Fast has spent more than a decade studying young people's experiences with housing in Vancouver. And she's currently working with a group of young Vancouverites, which includes Mazel, to develop solutions to the city's housing crisis. In her work, Danya notes that the government usually doesn't run its supportive and modular housing facilities themselves. Instead, they provide contracts to organizations like ATIRA to do the work. This housing plays a crucial role in keeping Vancouverites off the street, but it also tends to be unsafe, unsanitary, and undignified. In supportive housing, tenants can expect lots of surveillance, regular check-ins, room inspections, and limits on guests. And this all can make the facilities feel more like jail than home. In studies published in 2023 and 2024, Danya described what she'd been hearing from young people for years. That Vancouver's supportive and modular housing wasn't helping them stabilize their lives. Instead, they told Danya, their lives often become more precarious once they're in these places. If things became too chaotic or too stable, many ended up losing their housing and returning to homelessness. Danya also found that some young people actually preferred to remain on the street rather than cycle between these buildings, because they just didn't see any way to turn supportive housing into a real home.
And so there have been all these high-level changes and this fallout from the work you did, and as you say, the government reports on it. Do you feel optimistic that those changes are gonna result in better housing for vulnerable people in Vancouver?
I think there's a lot the government still needs to do. I think that they were focused on Atira as the bad apple, and they haven't looked at the entire supportive housing sector as a whole. It's like operating, allowing these basically sort of semi-institutional housing buildings to operate without any oversight whatsoever. And we know from the past, from like, you know, institutions that house people with disabilities or residential schools or whatever, like we know that whenever there's an institution that's being operated with no oversight, that bad things happen. And so I 100% guarantee you that there will be a scandal in the future if we don't set up some sort of arm's length ombudsman or some other regulator to be able to evaluate complaints and talk to these people and decide whether it's a valid complaint or not.
Like, what kind of supports could you have actually used? Like, what would have helped?
Somebody to help me with my mental health, somebody to help me with my physical health, somebody to help me with my drug addiction, you know? And that just never really happened.
Did this place, were you able to try and make it feel like home?
No. No. It never feels like home.
Mazel now has lived in multiple supportive housing buildings. And she says they're not really the kind of place where you can live a full life. For instance, when Mazel's girlfriend became pregnant, their building threatened to evict the young family because, they said, they didn't have the capacity to support parents. This was all but certain to lead to Mazel's daughter being thrown into the foster system. But Mazel says her girlfriend worked frantically and tirelessly to find a place that would allow all three of them. Today, Mazel and her former girlfriend are separated, and Mazel lives in a new supportive housing building, about a half an hour bus ride away.
My building used to be a Best Western, and when I moved in, it's got all the, everything in there is like just shit that was at the Best Western before, like side tables and stuff, like with the granite, fake granite top, you know. And the TV that's in there is mounted permanently in the corner of the wall, and when I turn it on, it has the Best Western logo that comes up. It's just, that's how it is, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I brought over everything for my daughter. Her crib, her toys, clothes,
so you're setting up
food
a place
and
for
shit.
Her.
Yeah.
You are trying to make this home,
yeah,
for your family.
Right? And for myself, at least, and my daughter to be able to stay there.
Yeah.
Right? At
yeah.
least that. And then they told me at the last second, no, your daughter can't come here. Like, oh, you can't have your daughter here. It's only over 18. I'm like, well, this is fucking news to me. Thanks.
So, I mean, it seems like your goals, you're pretty aware of them yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You tell people, like, you're wanting to feel safe. You're wanting to
yeah.
get sober. You're wanting to have a place for your daughter. You're wanting to have a place that can feel like home.
Yeah.
And you lived on the street, in SROs, and in supportive housing. But you're looking for a place, you want
yeah.
to be in a place that you can make a home.
Exactly.
That you can feel safe, that you can be the kind of parent you want to be.
Exactly, and that's way easier said than done.
For sure.
Especially in Vancouver.
But so our mayor has recently said, well, he's not going to build any more places. He's
yep.
not going to allow any more places like that in the city of Vancouver. But what do you think about that?
He can go fuck himself. When I heard that, it really fucked with me.
I mean, I think that's a really rational response when the mayor makes that announcement for you to think, go fuck yourself. Because he's basically telling you, your family, all of us,
yeah.
to go fuck ourselves.
Exactly.
That they don't want us in the city of Vancouver.
Yeah.
And we know there are like 17-year-olds getting off the bus in Vancouver today.
Yeah.
Trying to figure out what they're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
What do you want for that person who's in the position you were in, you know, 8 years ago or whatever?
I want things to be easy for them. I just want them to be able to... I want them to be able to navigate this system with help. With actual help. And somebody who actually cares about that person, you know? I want them to know that somebody actually cares about them and is there in their corner to fucking help them.
Some of the people listening may be thinking, oh, well, you've experienced these places being shitty, so why do you have a problem with the mayor saying, let's stop...
Yeah, like that's the thing is, yeah, some of them are shitty. Totally. But I think that is not a reason to stop them completely. That's a reason to look into them and change how they're operated.
I mean, just thanks for coming and talking to us and sharing so much of your life.
Yeah, thank you.
Very generous of you.
No, thank you for having me. I'm glad I could come.
Mazel's story is like many others we've told on the show over the past 6 years. A young person trying to access services to better their life, but being met instead with indifference and incompetence from the government. Instead of housing the homeless themselves, our leaders created a crown corporation. Then they handed out contracts to companies to do the work for them. These layers of abstraction are confusing, and they can obscure the basic fact that it's the government's responsibility to house the homeless. It's the government's responsibility to help young people in Mazel's position, and it's the government's responsibility to reduce overdoses from toxic drugs. Whether you live in a tent on Hastings Street, or in supportive housing, or you rent, it's hard to miss how little the government cares about you. People are losing hope because of this kind of deep, systemic neglect, and it's in this hopelessness that fascism has gotten a foothold in mainstream life. I think by now it's pretty clear that we can't wait for authority figures of any kind to solve the problem for us, that we're going to have to do it ourselves. And that means we need to organize and combine our movements. We need to work together, because if we don't, the future will be pretty bleak. Crackdown is produced on the territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations. Our editorial board is Dean Wilson, Jeff Loudon, Laura Shaver, Simona Marsh, Ellie Taylor, Delilah Gregg, and Martin Stewart. Rest in peace, Dave Murray, Greg Frez, Cherise Q. Watton, and Shelda Castor. This episode was conceptualized, written, and produced by Sam Fenn, Alex DeBoer, Dania Fast, Lisa Hale, and me, Garth Mullins. Mix by Alex Kim. Crackdown's theme song was written and produced by me and Sam. The episode also featured two songs made by Mazel, including the one you're hearing right now. All the other music was by Blue Dot Sessions. Thank you so much to Mazel for sharing her story. Also, thanks to Jen St. Denis. You can find links to Jen's work at crackdownpod.com. If you like what we do here at Crackdown, please support us at patreon.com/crackdownpod. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and keep six.